is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we'll hear about what a new cord blood center will mean to Central New York, plus how recent improvements in diabetes treatment have been reducing complications from this disease. But first, how close are we to a cure for HIV/AIDS? More than 250,000 babies are born worldwide each year infected with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. But in the last 2 years, scientists have reportedly cured several babies born with HIV through aggressive drug treatment soon after birth. The consequences of this could mean a profound breakthrough in the cure for this disease. We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Bernard Poise. He's professor of medicine and microbiology and the chief of hematology and oncology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Poise. Thanks for coming in. So there have been recent cases of curing babies born with HIV. Tell us about them.
Well, you'd have to say the data may be at the moment premature, but very optimistic, in that there's been a few children who have been born to mothers who were discovered to have HIV very late in their perinatal course, in their pregnancy. So those mothers did not have the benefit of being treated with antiretroviral therapy for a long time during their pregnancy. We know that, and that's the policy in most of the developed world, and thankfully now catching on in parts of the less developed world.
That is to treat the mothers early.
To treat the mother. You're treating the mother. The baby is also getting antiretroviral therapy in the baby's plasma as well. So it will work on the fetus as well. And we know that that maneuver dramatically decreases perinatal transmission of the virus. Here in the United States, transmission has dropped to very, very low levels. Also, we know that if a mother still has very high viral load, that it's probably better to deliver the baby by cesarean section so they don't swallow a lot of the mother's infected blood during the birthing process. In these few instances, the mothers were diagnosed way too late to do any of those maneuvers. Hence, their physicians decided to treat the baby instead of just low-dose drugs with high-dose concentrations of antiretroviral therapy, including up to three drugs in higher doses that you would give to an adult, if you will, per size, for an active HIV infection. And in these instances, and at least as best as I can tell from what the researchers have reported, they documented that for a temporary period of time, there was definite evidence that the babies were infected. This is done by doing what's called DNA PCR, not looking for antibodies to the virus, because this can pass from the mother to the baby, not looking for the virus particles with their RNA themselves, because that can pass from the mother, but looking for infected DNA inside the baby's own lymphocytes.
Thereby establishing firmly that the baby had HIV.
At least at that period in time when they tested, there was reasonable evidence to say that, yes, these few babies were definitely infected.
And would they use the same methodology to determine post-treatment that they no longer had the HIV?
Correct. They would do everything. They would test for antibodies, RNA, and DNA. What I don't know is, and it can sometimes be more sensitive, whether they attempted to culture the virus from the baby. And when you do that, you take the child's lymphocytes, grow them in vitro in the lab over a month's period of time to see if any HIV emerges from those cultures. I'm not 100% sure that they've done that.
But they did find that treating these babies aggressively with high doses, which is not routine, actually eradicated the virus.
Yes, over a period of time, they could no longer see any evidence, again, using these techniques, of the virus in the babies. The great debate is whether those babies should or should not come off antiretroviral therapy.
Ever, you mean?
Ever, yes. And no one knows the right answer.
I understand that there's a clinical trial in which up to 60 babies who are born infected will be put on drugs within 48 hours, and they're talking about that beginning soon. So if that trial works, what will be the consequences for treating babies born with HIV then?
Well, hopefully you will have a clinical trial, a randomized trial, and those are difficult to accrue to. Just think of what you would be saying to the baby and the parents.
You mean for those not treated?
For those not treated. We are going to randomize you to either get treatment or not treatment.
That's
will you
tough.
Agree to participate in this study? Some families will have a bias towards not treatment. Some families will have a bias towards treatment. So we'll have to see how well they accrue to that very difficult clinical trial to perform. But that is the only way that you will get any kind of evidence and long-term evidence to say, is this the right thing to do or not? Do you ultimately affect cure or long-term complete remissions, if you will? And that has an impact ultimately on the child's life and survival. And hopefully that will be done. And only that will give clear-cut guidance to clinicians in the future as to what's the right thing to do.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Bernard Poise, and we're talking about breakthroughs, potential breakthroughs in the cure for HIV. So coming around, what then? Let's assume that we have discovered a way to eradicate the virus from these newborns. What significance does that have in terms of a cure for HIV?
Well, number one, it affects policy, say, even in older persons, adults who get recently infected with HIV. That's a great debate at the moment as well. We all know in chronically infected adults that as the CD4 count decreases further and
what
further.
What does that mean, the CD4 count?
CD4 is a type of white blood cell, a T lymphocyte. That's the critical cell that HIV likes to live in.
That's what fights infection normally.
Correct. Yeah, it's a very important component of our immune system. And if it drops to very low levels, we become susceptible to all kinds of infections and malignancies.
And that's why the HIV basically puts us at risk.
Correct.
Because it devastates our immune system.
Right. It lowers those CD4s and other cells to such a limit that we cannot fight off very unusual infections on the planet. Currently, the treatment or the decision to treat adults with chronically infected HIV is made in part based on these CD4 levels. And I think most people would agree that a level between 300 to 500 cells, normally we have around 1,000 of these cells per cubic millimeter in our blood. And when we get below 200, we're susceptible to infection. In the old days, folks used to wait till a person dropped below that 200 level to initiate antiretroviral therapy. The concern was the toxicity of the therapy. You would only start to do it when you thought it was clinically necessary. Now we've kind of lowered that cutoff to around 300 to 500. And the question comes up, how about if you know that a person has become acutely infected? Should you start it sooner? If you did, would it make a difference in terms of their morbidity, their mortality, their survival over time?
So much like you're taking that model from the babies who've been acutely infected, you would take that same concept and treat adults.
Correct.
Who are acutely infected, means just got the
right.
Disease.
Yes, some people already feel from some of the limited studies done, again, this is very hard to do randomized trials in these instances because patients have a bias to begin with and do not wish to be randomized to observation versus treatment.
Most of them want treatment is the point.
Well, actually, it goes both ways. It's the same in our cancer care. People will
choose
not opt
to
for
or
the
not.
Placebo versus the treatment. They'll have a bias one way or the other and refuse to be randomized on the trial. So it takes a while to gather this data. There's already a feeling that if a person, an adult, acutely infected with HIV has symptoms of that infection, much like the symptoms you get with mononucleosis, that it probably is in their betterment if you start treatment early rather than waiting till they drop to this cutoff level of CD4 counts. It's not so clear on folks that are asymptomatic, but there's a bias, just as was applied in these young children, of perhaps we should be treating early.
But is the point here that if you treat early, much like with the infants, that you could eradicate the disease from them? And then a secondary question is, do they require then to remain on these antiviral drugs in perpetuity, I mean, for their entire lives?
Mm-hmm. Well, the holy grail would obviously be cure. I would have to say that most folks, even with this interesting data that we're talking about in these children, most researchers and investigators would feel that that's probably unlikely to happen in the overwhelming majority of infections.
Meaning a cure.
Where you would completely eradicate it. Now, the term functional cure comes up, where you've suppressed the virus to such low levels that during the lifetime of the infected person, it never causes a clinical problem. Frankly, that's what exists already in non-human primates. We know that HIV-1 and HIV-2 are relatively recent transmissions from non-human primates to humans. The non-human primates, over thousands of years of these infections, have worked out a symbiotic relationship with the virus. They don't get sick.
It's interesting.
They functionally are cured. It doesn't cause a big clinical problem.
Could one hypothesize that in several, however many years, that humans would adjust in the same way?
Well, that's happened to a degree in that we know that there are people that, because of certain mutations in receptors and other genes within the cell, are relatively resistant to HIV infection, or at least if they get infected, they do not transmit the virus to an overwhelming number of their critical
CD4 cells. So we already
do
see that in the human.
Yeah, but we humans and medical science have intervened, and no one would ever allow to occur on the planet the process where all humans would be exposed to HIV and not treated, and by natural selection, we would wind up with
right.
the humans that were relatively immune to it. But that's actually what's happened in the non-human primates by natural selection
right.
selected those non-human primates that are relatively resistant to SIV.
How about something like gene editing? I was reading about that, this idea that you can actually go in these days and do something to the gene that was, in this case, I guess, responsible for the protein or something that the HIV latches onto, and by changing that and then giving those cells back to the person, that you could actually make them more immune?
Well, this is a long-standing idea. We know that all HIV, like all retroviruses, uses the cell's own machinery to replicate. And we know what some of those critical steps are. The concept is if you could take a critical reservoir of the person's own cells, edit them, change the genes such that it was now difficult for HIV to replicate.
It would repel the virus.
It would repel the virus or limit the the extension throughout the body.
So you're thinking this is something they're beginning to look at.
Absolutely.
It's probably long way off.
But yeah, it because of the understanding of the basic science of the virus, you should be able to attack it.
How about this Berlin patient, which is another question that people are raising? This young man who had a bone marrow transplant because he had leukemia and he had AIDS, or HIV, and they found that after that he was apparently cured.
Well, correct. He was on very good treatment for his HIV, and it was in his own cells. Because of his leukemia, he underwent an allogeneic transplant. His own immune and hematopoietic cells were destroyed with chemotherapy, and he received another person's cells. Not only were those cells not infected, they were protected because he was on antiretroviral therapy, and those cells attacked his cells and destroyed them.
So that's not surprising.
No, it's not surprising that it theoretically could be a therapy. It's just very
risky, expensive.
A lot of morbidity, a lot of mortality, and very expensive.
So briefly, what do you think about our breakthroughs for HIV, a cure? Do you think see that in the next 10 years, 15 years?
I don't think for the vast majority of infected patients that there's reasonable optimism that they can be cured. I think what you're finding is you can make HIV infection a chronic disease that the folks live and maintain a quality of life for longer and longer periods of time. And that would be the hope, that you could extend it such that it was just a chronic treatable disease that did not result in death.
Well, I want to thank you for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Bernard Poise. He's a professor of medicine and microbiology and the chief of hematology and oncology at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, what will the new Upstate Cord Blood Bank mean for our region? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on air. Linda Cohen here with you. Umbilical cord blood is the blood that remains in the placenta and umbilical cord after childbirth. It's a rich source of stem cells that have the potential of being used in the treatment of dozens of diseases, like cancer and sickle cell anemia. And here with more on this is Dr. Nicholas Greco. He's the Executive Director and the Tissue Bank Director of the Upstate Cord Blood Bank. Welcome, Dr. Greco.
My pleasure.
So umbilical cord blood is an important source of stem cells. Help us understand what we mean by that, and what do we mean by umbilical cord blood?
Cord blood is the blood that remains in the umbilical cord in the placenta, and it's collected after the mother delivers the baby.
And why is it a source of stem cells?
It actually serves as the stem cells for the developing fetus, and then the cells circulate throughout the circulation of the baby.
So how do we get this blood?
It's collected by phlebotomy after the mother delivers the baby.
In what way? In other words, they literally take the blood from the umbilical cord and the placenta? When you say phlebotomy, they draw the blood out?
Draw the blood out with a needle directly into a collection bag.
And these cells have some very important potential benefit to us. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. They are considered a pluripotent stem cell source.
Explain pluripotent.
And I will. There's three types of potency. One is a totipotency, which allows the reconstruction of the 220 different tissues in the body.
So, okay, if a cell is totipotent mm-hmm. versus pluripotent, it means that the totipotent cell can be anything. It can be a hair cell, it could be a heart cell, it could be a liver cell. Is that correct?
That's correct. And it also generates the reproductive tissues. And that's the difference between a totipotent stem cell and a more differentiated, a more mature pluripotent cell, which loses the ability to generate reproductive tissue.
So it can do everything else but reproductive tissue?
Exactly.
Okay, so it can't be our reproductive organs, but it could be a heart.
Absolutely.
It could be a hair cell. It could be an eye cell.
That's exactly right. And as pluripotent stem cells become more mature, they become a multipotential stem cell, and these cells are limited in their capability to become a specific cell line,
tissue. As they mature, that means they are less...
differentiated. Able to differentiate into different tissues.
They can't be as many. It restricts what they can do.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's get to the bottom line here. I mean, there's been so much controversy over decades and decades about the use of unborn fetuses as a source of stem cells. And obviously there are religious and moral reasons why people object to this. How does the idea of a stem cell from an umbilical cord or placenta change this story?
It changes the paradigm completely, such that embryonic stem cells are not needed in this context of using cord blood. In the generation of an embryonic stem cell, a sperm interacts with an egg to form a fertilized oocyte, and this cell is capable of multiple pluripotency. A totipotency in only the first few divisions, and then it becomes a pluripotent stem cell, just like the cells that are found in cord blood.
So the idea is, if you can harvest all of these pluripotent stem cells from umbilical cord blood or placental blood, you never need unborn fetuses as the source?
That's true.
Well, that's pretty significant.
Yes, it actually eliminates the argument for the using embryonic stem cells.
So tell us about this idea of a blood bank for this type of blood. Why do we need a blood bank, and is this going on elsewhere in the country?
Yes, across the world, there's approximately 30 public cord blood banks in the United States and approximately 100 throughout the entire world. And many organizations are involved with collecting cord blood for this particular activity.
For the sheer purpose of using them for all kinds of new research and treatments. Is that correct?
Exactly.
So I understand that Upstate is constructing a new building to house this kind of cord blood, this new cord blood bank. Where are we at, or where are you at in that construction and that development?
The construction is underway at Community General.
On the
Community General campus, exactly. And we're actually engaged with the FDA. We have a meeting with them in mid-June to review our construction documents, which will allow us to produce a manufacturing facility. It's called a good manufacturing facility, and a GMP facility, which will allow us to produce a safe product for transplant recipients.
Okay, so let's understand more about that. Tell us, what are the kinds of treatments that are either currently undertaken using this kind of stem cells currently? Why don't we just start with that? What's being done now?
Currently, what is FDA approved as indications are all blood-borne cancers, so leukemia, lymphoma, multiple myeloma. And these are actually rare disease, thankfully. Incidence is about 20,000 in the United States, 20,000 cases per year, and worldwide it's around 50,000 cases per year. Emerging research and clinical use of cord blood is in all non-cancers, so cerebral palsy, type 1 diabetes, regenerative medicine areas. The purpose of the cord blood is to replace the bone marrow of the patient, because all of the indications, leukemias, all the inborn errors of metabolism that Dr. Silverman mentioned on a previous version of your show, sickle cell anemia, all of these diseases originate in the bone marrow. So the whole purpose of a cord blood graft, the product itself, is to replace the bone marrow of a patient.
Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Nicholas Greco. We're talking about this new cord blood bank and what it will do. So I want to get a little clearer on this. So the idea is that if you have leukemia or some of these multiple myeloma, some of these blood-borne diseases, in order to basically cure this person, you need to replace their bone marrow, and you're going to be doing it with these kinds of cells. Is that correct?
Exactly. These are adult stem cells.
And that will eliminate what's being produced that's bad in their blood?
Right. All of the cancer cells originate from the bone marrow. And what the transplant center will do is with the chemotherapeutic drugs and total body irradiation, or the specific protocol for a transplant center, essentially destroy the bone marrow of a patient. The cord blood then is peripherally infused. It migrates, the cord blood stem cells migrate to the bone marrow and start to repopulate the bone marrow.
So they get a brand new bone marrow from this umbilical cord blood.
Exactly, and then they replace all of the blood-borne elements. All of the cells in the blood are replaced by the donor's cord blood.
And they're healthier, obviously.
And healthier.
Oh, they're healthy.
Cured,
they're not,
right.
They're
it's
cured.
Just not a treatment, it's a cure.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And that's currently being undertaken right now.
Sure, there's more than 30,000 cord blood transplants that have taken place since 1988. The first one was Falcone's anemia. It's actually not a cancer. It's a blood marrow deficiency.
Would this be true for things like sickle cell anemia as well?
Absolutely. It is a cure for sickle cell anemia, most prevalent in pediatric populations. And actually, it's the largest group of non-cancers treatable and cured by cord blood.
Wow. So this will have an enormous impact on the Central New York medical community.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that. In what way?
Right. It impacts the ability to offer a patient another source of adult stem cells, in contrast to two other sources of adult stem cells, that being bone marrow and mobilized peripheral stem cells. And that's also a bone marrow product. So it offers patients another tissue type, another adult cell type, to be able to be cured of their diseases.
So it really will promote a lot more cures in this area.
Absolutely. But the tip of the iceberg, in my mind, is the cure of cancer. That actually is the proof of concept, so to speak, that cord blood is a safe product. Below the wave line, essentially, is the regenerative medicine, the ability of cord blood-derived stem cells to regenerate other tissues.
So let's go specifically to that. For example, there's been a lot of talk about some of the neurologic diseases, like MS or Parkinson's. Do you see some of these stem cells playing a role there as well?
Absolutely. The non-cancer use of cord blood, actually the largest group of clinical trials are in neurological diseases, and these are autism, cerebral palsy, hypoxic brain injury, stroke, many of these diseases are neurological in their origin.
So these stem cells that you get from the cord blood, what has to happen to them to make them ready for this kind of these kinds of treatments?
Now, that's a really interesting question, and that will take some time. But what we know at this particular point is that if you take selected stem cells from cord blood in the right environment of growth factors, that you can guide these cells to become a heart cell, a cardiomyocyte, or a hepatocyte, which is a liver cell, or an islet cell. And so what this allows is a possibility that if you expand these cells and direct these cells, you may be able to cure various diseases.
That go beyond even what we were talking about, absolutely. Even beyond the blood type of diseases. For example, could you imagine someday being able to rebuild someone's liver?
Absolutely.
Or pancreas with pancreatic cancer, for example?
Absolutely. At my lab at Case Western Reserve University, we did specifically that. We were able to take cord blood and in 14 days generate hepatocytes. And hepatocytes are liver cells constituting 70 to 80% of a liver. And these cells are very important to detoxify all of the bad toxins that we take in, but also produce a number of very important serum-derived proteins, including albumin, which is a very important transporter protein in the blood.
So you would repair a liver, in this perhaps a diseased liver in this
way? Absolutely.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's pretty amazing stuff.
Absolutely.
Let me get, before we run out of time, how is the cord blood donated?
The cord blood is donated by a consent process. We approach expectant parents around 35 weeks of gestation, and we make them aware of the program by education. Dr. Robert Silverman has been involved with this in a previous era of your show, and will be the medical director of the facility of the collection hospitals, and he's very proactive with the support of this program.
So the idea is a medical provider. I mean, you make an agreement with a patient, and then is it right after delivery that the umbilical cord and the umbilical cord is cut and clamped, a syringe is placed into the umbilical vein, and they, as you said, they remove that cord blood?
Exactly. The collection of cord blood does not interfere at all with the birthing process. That's an absolute requirement. It's actually a secondary to the birthing process.
And that cord and that placenta would basically be thrown away as medical waste.
Exactly.
And what you're talking about is something that could change the lives of millions of people.
Absolutely.
If we harvest this very, very, it's like gold.
It's a true altruistic donation. It's very similar to the American Red Cross when we provide peripheral blood.
So how could people donate cord blood if they wanted to?
Over the next year, we will be educating expectant parents at three hospitals in Syracuse, Upstate University Hospital Community Campus, Krause and St. Joseph, and then we'll be reaching out to nine other hospitals in the central New York area.
So the word will get out and people will be told and understand how they can actually participate in this.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Well, it's so hopeful. It's such hopeful news for the general medical community, but specifically for our upstate community. Thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Nicholas Greco. He's the executive director and the tissue bank director of the Upstate Cord Blood Bank. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now we'd like to share with you something that happened during Upstate's College of Medicine commencement recently. One of the graduating medical students was chosen to speak, and as part of his presentation, the new Dr. Dan Harris pulled out his ukulele to the delight of the audience. Now, there are a couple of references to deans and medical education, but we thought it was very clever and worth hearing. So, here it is.
Not such a long, long time ago. Does anyone remember how med school sometimes made us smile? Yes, I knew if we had a chance, we could make Paul Shanley dance. And maybe he'd be happy for a while. This February made me tremble with every rank list I assembled. Now there's big news on the doorstep, and oh man, I cannot stand the word stem. And I can't remember much at all, but I'll recite the oath and heed the call, and I will not go to school this fall. Today, we graduate and become doctors. Today, we graduated and became doctors. So did you read the book, Robbins, and did you have faith in accreditation when Dr. Duggan told us so? Now do you believe in pharmaceuticals? Can evidence save your patient's soul? And can you admit to everything that you don't know? Well, I know that you chose a medicine to change the world you're living in. So walk a mile in your patient's shoes, 'cause I know that that's still true. We'll be lonely interns, donning scrubs, our hearts that pounding like a love hubbub, but we're going to make it in BT-dubs.
Improved treatments reduced complications from diabetes. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I am Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for June 2nd. With the proliferation of apps, websites, and books devoted to nutrition, it's never been easier to accurately track your calories. Understanding your daily consumption habits is an essential first step on the road to losing or maintaining weight, provided you don't blatantly miscategorize foods. We're looking at you, Carrot Cake. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Federal researchers recently reported the first broad national picture of progress against some of the most devastating complications of diabetes, which affects millions of Americans, and they found that rates of heart attacks, strokes, kidney failure, and amputations fell sharply over the past two decades. We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Ruth Weinstock. She's professor of medicine and the division chief of endocrinology, diabetes, and metabolism at Upstate Medical University, and she's also the medical director of the Joslin Diabetes Center at Upstate. Welcome, Dr. Weinstock. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So rates of some of these really serious complications from diabetes have declined. Tell us about that. What were the biggest declines?
So the biggest decline was an approximate two-thirds reduction in heart attacks, what we call acute myocardial infarctions and death, which is really, you know, wonderful news, quite striking results, and a 50% reduction in stroke and amputation. There's also a 30% reduction in end-stage renal disease, that's kidney failure.
Before we go on, that's staggering, and I want to go over all of those in detail, but let's review the numbers in general in this country. How many Americans now have diabetes?
Over 21 million Americans have been diagnosed with diabetes, and there are many more individuals who probably have diabetes but are not yet diagnosed.
So they're kind of, are they pre-diabetic or they actually have the disease?
Well, there are a huge number of people with pre-diabetes, way more than have diabetes. But also, unfortunately, there are people who don't get regularly screened for diabetes and have diabetes and don't know it.
Are these largely people with type 2 diabetes? I know I read somewhere that's the type that is often related to obesity and the more common form of the disease. But there is type 1 and type 2.
Yeah.
Are they both growing?
They're both growing, actually. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. It has its most common onset in younger individuals, but adults can also be diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, even older adults. So people with type 1 diabetes, their insulin-producing cells have been destroyed by autoimmunity, and so they must take insulin.
So they're totally insulin-dependent.
Exactly.
But the type 2 diabetes, which has been mostly in the news.
Right. So type 2 diabetes is what's been associated with obesity and sedentary lifestyle, and those individuals may be able to prevent or at least forestall the development of the disease with diet, exercise, weight management, and can be controlled, many of them, with oral agents or injectables, although about half of adults with type 2 diabetes also require insulin.
But those people with type 2 diabetes basically usually acquire it as a result of some of these things we talked about, lifestyle choices, weight.
They probably have a genetic predisposition to develop the disease. Family history is a huge risk factor. But in those who have that genetic predisposition, when they become overweight or obese and become sedentary, they need more insulin to keep their blood sugars normal. And if their insulin-producing cells cannot do that, they develop diabetes.
And I've heard even children these days can begin to develop type 2 diabetes,
yes,
which I thought was unheard of in a way.
Yep,
at one
we
time.
Have some preteens and teenagers with type 2 diabetes.
Wow. And you also mentioned that there's a large number. I read a statistic that was staggering. 79 million Americans have pre-diabetes. That means that they're on the verge of developing it.
Yes, so that means that their blood glucose levels, which is blood sugar levels, are above normal, but not yet high enough to be considered to have the diagnosis of diabetes. So they are at greatly increased risk of developing diabetes.
Let's go back to the complications or the reduction of complications over the last two decades. What is this new data that they've just put together? Tell us about current diabetes treatment. I mean, are we being better at treating the disease and hence less complications?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, the good news is we're better at treating the disease and preventing complications. The bad news is more people have the disease, so
exactly.
The burden is still huge for the country. But we are much better at controlling blood sugar levels, and that is directly related to the development of many of these complications. But we're also much better at treating other risk factors that we know are related to development of complications. So, for example, the use of statin drugs, which reduce the bad cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol, is thought to be playing a major role in the reduction in heart attacks and strokes we're seeing. The use of ACE inhibitors, which is a type of drug that's used for hypertension, also is helping reduce end-stage kidney disease. So there are other medications, not only blood glucose control, blood sugar control, but also attacking blood pressure and other metabolic abnormalities such as cholesterol levels that are important. In addition, for the amputations, I think we're much better in educating people with diabetes on how best to take care of themselves. That's so critical, not just lifestyle, but also in terms of the amputations, inspecting their feet, how to take care of their feet, how to prevent foot problems, how to recognize an early foot problem so it could be treated and thereby preventing a major foot problem that could lead to amputation.
So education plays a huge role in all of this.
Huge role. At our diabetes center, we have classes, we have nurse educators, dietitians. It's a whole team approach to help people learn how to best take care of themselves.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Ruth Weinstock, and we're talking about the decline in serious complications from diabetes over the past 20 years. Another piece of this in terms of education is also the fact that doctors are more willing or more able to track patients over time and to keep on top of their blood sugars and what have you, and make sure that if they go off track, that they go back on track.
There have been a lot of advances, a lot of technological advances that have been extremely helpful. Better ways of for the patient to monitor their own blood sugars, use of computers, use of phone apps to help people with both lifestyle change and also to track how much insulin they're taking or what their blood sugars have been.
How about
the electronic medical records also, which help healthcare providers better track all these different risk factors and medications that patients are on and things that lab values that need to be optimized with different medications.
So less falls through the cracks in that respect.
And there's also less smoking in this country. So smoking is a huge risk factor for vascular disease, which can affect the heart, the stroke rates. And so I think the fact that there are more smoking cessation programs and that healthcare providers are very active in trying to help their patients now stop smoking is important.
How did they put this data together? They were looking at data over the past 20 years. Where did it come from?
So these were statisticians from the Centers for Disease Control that have access to databases that cover the whole United States, and they actually use four different databases: the National Health Interview Survey, the National Hospital Discharge Survey, U.S. Renal Data System, and the U.S. National Vital Statistics System. So they had access to nationwide data.
And this was important, I think, because in a way we really do need some kind of a checklist or a checkpoint to see how we're doing. Because as you said so eloquently, the good news is we are reducing complications, but we are also increasing the numbers of people with diabetes. So over time, we really do need to continue to track.
And the burden continues to increase because of the great increase in the prevalence of diabetes, both in the U.S. and worldwide. But as more physician practices and provider practices have electronic records, I think we'll have even better data as the years go on.
What role has the pump? People actually can have a pump physically inserted?
So the insulin pump is used mostly in type 1 diabetes. At our diabetes center, over a half of our children and over half of our adults use insulin pumps. And it's an insulin delivery system that allows more precise delivery of insulin during the day and night. We also have continuous glucose sensors now that can be connected to the pumps that are particularly useful for people who have wide fluctuations in blood sugars, especially in people who have a tendency for their blood sugars to go too low, which is a huge problem in particularly people with type 1 diabetes who've had it for a long period of time. And the most recently, and actually we did some of this research, is a sensor that talks to the pump. So this is actually, we're very excited about this. There's the first insulin pump now where if your blood sugar goes low, the sensor detects that, the pump will stop infusing insulin. So it's been shown that you actually spend less time hypoglycemic or in blood sugars that are too low, particularly when you're sleeping.
That's very exciting.
So there are a lot of very exciting new developments.
And that's never used with people with type 2 diabetes?
Well, actually, we are involved in a research project for type 2 diabetes with insulin pumps, as well as continuing our research in type 1 diabetes with pumps.
I found it noteworthy that the researchers from the Centers for Disease Control estimate that diabetes and its complications account for $176 billion in medical costs every year. That's a staggering number.
It is, and that doesn't include all the other ancillary losses in terms of quality of life and lost work days and other problems.
So what's the takeaway in terms of what we are doing at this point? I mean, And do you also see some other breakthroughs on the horizon to help reduce this burden?
So there are a lot of exciting areas of research right now. We are working on an artificial pancreas project with other diabetes centers.
What does that mean?
So we want to try to be able to really control blood glucose levels in people that require insulin therapy, so they won't have to worry about how much insulin to inject, about their sugars going too high or too low, but that there would be a pump and sensor system that would automatically give them the right amount of insulin so their blood glucose levels always stay in the correct
range. So it's the next level up from what you were just describing.
Oh, yeah, actually several levels
up.
But we're making, every year we're trying to get closer and closer to that goal. There are other new drugs for type 2 diabetes. Huge amount of research on prevention of diabetes. Clearly, you know, we want to better manage it and cure it for the people who have it, but we want to prevent it.
So where is the key then, or the magic bullet for prevention? I mean, when you talk prevention, what are you talking about?
So I don't think there's going to be one key, because diabetes is quite heterogeneous. So type 1 diabetes, for example, which is also increasing every year, and is not associated with the obesity epidemic, that's more of an autoimmune disease, and that's going to be hopefully someday a vaccination. It's going to be an immunological intervention to prevent that disease, we hope. Type 2 diabetes, we do hope that healthier lifestyles can help prevent or forestall the development of the disease. There may even be some environmental toxins that are related to development of all types of diabetes, and that's something that is another area of research.
Or even a change in our environment, like getting rid of the high fructose corn syrup that's mm-hmm. in every product on the market. Things that are actually adding to our weight gain, that kind of stuff.
And possibly some chemicals, possibly bacteria. I mean, there are viruses or a variety of
possible
areas of research.
Well, you are doing a lot of clinical research. In the little bit of time we have left, how can people get involved if they want to?
So please give our clinical research unit a call at 315-464-9007, and we'd be happy to tell you about the different types of clinical projects that are going on for both type 1 and type 2 diabetes.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Ruth Weinstock, Professor of Medicine and the Division Chief of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at Upstate Medical University, and she's the Director of the Joslin Diabetes Center at Upstate. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. I'd like to read a poem by Ithaca poet Laura Glenn. Her latest book is I Can't Say I'm Lost, from Foothills Publishing. In this poem, Depth Perception, she talks about how the death of a parent can conjure up not only the ghost of the past, but a long-lost faith in things unseen. Here is Depth Perception. Last year, walking this path, wind blew through a pine tree. For an instant, I saw the ghost of the tree made entirely of pollen and shaped like a pine float through the air. Something about this evening light, distant streetlights cast long reflections across the lake, shrouded, amber-tinted, and shaped like upright bodies, bandaged by the light like mummies, though I also think Ganges. It's the dead, I say, and start to cry. Father, I whisper. I start to connect to one of the reflections. They're like cocoons, as if something might emerge, and my father and I might continue things said and left unsaid, heard and not heard. Down the lake of time, the reflections appear in sequence, staggered and stagnant for the moment, like the gone. My father loved travel, India, Egypt, everywhere. Where are you going now, brave voyager? As solid-looking as the lamplight's reflections, reflections of car lights move fast, as if there's no one here they need to stop and see. I head home on my walk, treading soft needles to humus. My father, with his gift for making something of life, now is light on water, illumined, swaddled like a mummy, about to start a new life. And some part of me can't stop entertaining thoughts I don't believe in.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when the CEO of the American Cancer Society briefs us on the progress made in fighting cancer, plus how the navigational bronchoscope can save lives. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's healthlinkonair.org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink On Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.